The Bethlehem event began a trickle of stories that, with the passing of each annual cycle, has developed into an avalanche of fables, tales, and legends. The evolution of Christmas stories will never cease. Matthew was probably the first written collection of Christmas accounts, but Luke's stories have an equal claim to antiquity. The first storytellers were the shepherds, and the story that they told had three parts: the announcement of the angel, the singing of the heavenly host, and the discovery of the holy child with his parents in the stable cave. The Magi would have been better storytellers because obviously they were formally educated, but they were forbidden to do so by angelic dreams. But that prohibition has deterred no one else from telling stories. For 2,000 years each Christmas, people construct their own stories, with some stories only as apocryphal variations of the first ones, and others having no resemblance to them at all. But regardless of how far removed later Christmas stories develop from the first one, they are not totally devoid of religious themes. They are all attempts to offer some type of good news to people who are doomed forever not to have the good news unless they invent it for themselves. For so perverse is the human nature that it creates its own gospels when the reality of the situation proclaims an absolutely morbid condition. Consider how our first mother, Eve, heard only the promise of salvation in Genesis 3 and ignored the prediction of impending woes. And thus, when Cain was born, she thought that the glorious reign of the Messiah had come. Thus she became the first fanatic, inventing good news from her own heart, when in fact she had given birth to the world's first murderer. A few secular Christmas stories may demonstrate the point. A Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens, The Grinch That Stole Christmas, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, and The Nutcracker Suite. All these Christmas stories have one thing in common: a miserable situation for the central character is resolved by a happy, redemptive ending. By first making the listeners feel miserable, and then concluding with a they lived happily ever after ending, you might want to call it the law of gospel punch. Take, for example, the miserly Scrooge, who after a few hellish dreams repents and at least shows his good works by paying for somebody else's dinner. The law, with or without God, is always marvelous for correcting behavior and instant conversion. The story of Rudolph is of a different genre. The poor fellow's luminous nose is the butt of a continuous round of ridicule from his comrades. The antlered creature is raised from his humility, not because anybody loves him, but only when it is discovered that his deformity can be an asset in spatial navigation. I have yet to hear of a Christmas story that does not have a good ending, though I do not deny that someone will try to invent one. So without ever using the biblical imagery, these stories all have a kind of a theological theme. And the stories is that evil is only temporary and that good will triumph in the end. First comes the law and then comes the gospel. If Bultmann demythologized these stories, then the current stories have been re-mythologized so that modern man can understand some kind of message in his own terms. But could we reverse the process and look at our own Christmas stories in the same way? For example, the first collection of Christmas stories tells about a woman whose unborn child is thought to come from an adulterous union. The child turns out to be the child of prophecy. Some Babylonian scholars, probably with a few pagan beliefs, find themselves lost in Jerusalem. The happy ending is that a star takes them to Bethlehem, where they find the holy child. The holy innocents are slaughtered by Herod, but the one child escapes the savage butchery and finds security in Egypt. The second collector of Christmas stories is equally effective, perhaps, in telling us how bad things turn out okay. The childless priestly couple eventually do have a son in their old age who turns out to be the world's greatest prophet. A young, insignificant girl, barely into her teens, conceives a child without a father. Some not overly skilled husbanders of animals, doomed to the night shift, have the honor of being the only audience for the most magnificent choir ever assembled, with, of course, the exception of our own chapel performers. And two ancient temple servants, whittling away their last days on earth, have their torturous waiting rewarded with the appearance of the Lord Christ in the sacred precincts. And who would have ever thought that after everything man did against God, and all of the frightening things that God visited against man in his righteous judgment, especially as they are recorded in the Old Testament, God would have ever sent his son at Christmas. It's all a kind of a series of bad stories with a happy ending. It's like re-Christianizing a Christmas carol. Now, to be sure, God is not like Scrooge, because God is not arbitrary. He gives to every man his reward and his punishment. And God had every reason to withhold his love, his kindness, his mercy, his compassion, because the creatures had deserted their creator with lawless murder, adultery, evil thoughts, and the worship of other gods, the highest form of unfaithfulness and disloyalty towards heaven. Finally, at Christmas, God repents of his unkind thoughts and comes to the aid of the ungrateful creature. This Christmas kindness, however, should not be taken too lightly, however, because the people who were sitting in darkness and in the shadow of death may again find that the lights go out if they offend God too much. Because, after all, Christmas is only one day in God's eternity. That bad beginning and good ending to the Christmas story was so convincing that I am almost believing it myself. Of course, it keeps Christ in Christmas. But keeping or putting Christ back into Christmas hardly means that it's Christian at all. In fact, the stories we're just told are extremely dangerous, and dangerous to salvation. That kind of story reflects what a contemporary Reformed theologian, Klaus Runia, just wrote about the Bible, and I think he reflects what a lot of Christians really believe about Christmas. The transcendent, far removed, and often angry God of the Old Testament makes the impossible leap to cross the chasm between heaven and earth to come to the aid of flesh and blood men wallowing around in the misery caused by his own sin. The Old Testament is the bad story, and the New Testament is the good story. Law and gospel, if you will. A lot of people believe it, but it is not true. Because the truth of the matter is this: God did not first become Emmanuel, God with us, in Matthew chapter 1. But since Genesis 3, he has never ceased being Emmanuel, the God who was with us. Adam was removed from the garden, but God did not remove himself from Adam. There is nothing to suggest that the ethical lives of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and the 12 patriarchs ever pleased God or earned his grace. They not only refused to trust him, but their unbelief they added stealing, murder, adultery, and incest. And the great King David, who was God's all-time favorite, was not much better. But in every case, God proved that what in spite of what they did, he was there as their Emmanuel, the God who was with them. And that's what grace is all about. Not that God loves the holy and the righteous in themselves, but he loves those who are unholy and unrighteous and have no righteousness of their own and make no proclamation of their righteousness and do not declare their righteousness to others. So God's rescue and redemption of those Old Testament sinners is declaring them righteous and is turning them into saints was happening in their own time. Eve did see Seth, a son called upon the Lord's name, and she saw the Lord's salvation. David did see Solomon, who embodied within himself that final principle, the future one, who called himself the true and greater Solomon, even our Lord Jesus Christ, to whom be glory forever and ever. And even when Isaiah foretold the conception of the Emmanuel child, God was right then and there, bringing redemption and salvation to his people by protecting Jerusalem from invasion. The appearance of the Emmanuel child in Jesus means that God is raising to a higher and an eternally permanent dimension of reality in flesh and blood, that truth which has never ceased to be true from the foundation of the world, that God is always with his people. He is Emmanuel. Christmas is not unexpected good news, but a more magnificent proclamation of what God was saying all the time. God's good news that he is Emmanuel did not become first universalized when the angel said that the good tidings were for all people, but it was already universalized by the prophets and by God himself when he said in the garden that all humanity would be present in the holy seed of the woman to bring Satan down to one final calamitous defeat. Even Paul knew that Emmanuel embraced all people when he said that the grace of God has appeared to all men. God is not sometimes love and sometimes anger. God is always love. And Christmas is not one event. If Christmas is not one event in God's history, Christmas might be one day and one event in our history, but in God's history, it is the only event. And thus, the story of Christmas must be retold in the passing of every annual cycle so that every generation may believe that God is no less Emmanuel today than he was to Mary or Joseph, to Isaiah or to Eve. Luther said in his Christmas cradle hymn that Lutherans love to quote, that we must go with the shepherds to Bethlehem to see what the Lord has done. And in this 300th anniversary year, we cannot overlook the truly theological genius of Bach, who is forever interrupting the singing of the biblical narrative with existential magnificence to place the Christian today in the manger and in the angelic chorus and in the cross and in the grave and in the resurrection and even at God's right hand. But of course, before Bach did it, Paul did it first, and you'll be the judge of who did it better. Christmas preaching is proclamation, but it is also incarnational participation. Emmanuel means God shares in our lives in a sacramental way, so that by permeating our humanity, he elevates all of us from our weakness into his glory. Jesus demonstrated that he was this kind of sacramental Emmanuel when he ate with sinners and tax collectors as their guest. And in bread and wine, he not only continues to banquet with us sinners, but we become his guests. And now we feed on him who is the eternal food of heaven. In the Holy Sacrament, we have the tangible reality of Emmanuel, God with us, God for us, and yes, now even God in us. Luther and the formula of Concord saw this clearly, but they said this, that when you speak about incarnational presence, you had better also begin to speak about sacramental presence. For if you deny that God is Emmanuel in the sacrament, you will also deny that he is Emmanuel incarnate in Jesus. This incarnational presence of the Emmanuel child belongs to our total existence, our eating, our drinking, and life's every moment. The sacrament makes us part of him who at Christmas became part of us. And it was not a false accusation leveled against Jesus by his enemies when they said, "Behold, a glutton and a winebibber. He who was the bridegroom on earth partied, banqueted, and feasted with sinners in participation and anticipation of the final banquet, when we would not only feast on him, but we would see him with our eyes. We would see him with our eyes, who is the total embodiment of everything that is in the Old Testament, so that when we finally do see Jesus, we will see him who is the Lamb, who is the temple, who is David, who is Solomon, who is Elijah, who is Moses. And at this blessed time, we need no reminder of the Lord's reality of life's misery, of sickness, death, and disappointment. But the only thing which we do need is the reminder of the gospel's invitation to unbridled and unrestrained joy at the coming of the Emmanuel child. This unbridled joy removes the false boundaries of the Pharisees raised between the religious and the secular, because Emmanuel and incarnation mean that everything belongs to God. We need no puritanical harbingers of doom who are forever curtailing the universal dimension of incarnation. The symbols of the Christmas tree, the boar's head, the yule log, the mistletoe, even some of those foolish stories, those pagan symbols of our Christmas celebration, have now become God's trophies to show that Jesus, the Emmanuel child, has subjected all things under his feet in accordance with Genesis 3. And now he is conquered as the Lord of all lords and the God of all gods. Genesis 3 has come true. And Jesus himself proclaimed what the word Emmanuel meant, the name given to him by the prophet Isaiah, when at the end of his lifetime he said that Emmanuel meant this: "Lo, I am with you even to the end of the age." All this means that a blessed Christmas can only be a merry one.